Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday the 2nd of May, these are our main stories. More than 100,000 refugees flee Sudan since the clashes between rival military factions started 2 weeks ago, and the UN warns it could get a lot worse. The widow of a prominent Islamic Jihad militant who died while on hunger strike in an Israeli jail says she wants no bloodshed in response. The leader of a Kenyan doomsday cult has appeared in court, accused of encouraging his followers to starve themselves to death. Also in this podcast, the migrants who can't get into Peru and the Hollywood writers who are out on strike.
We are not neurosurgeons. We are not curing cancer. We are all very well aware of that. But I think what we do is special, and I think it deserves to be valued.
In just 2 weeks, more than 100,000 people have fled Sudan. According to the United Nations, this will exceed 800,000 if the fighting continues between the army and paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Information is key for anyone in Sudan right now. And here on the BBC, a new service is being launched today to provide this. We'll hear more on this in a moment. But first, let's listen to Dr. Ahmed Al-Mandari from the World Health Organization, who is responsible for operations in Sudan. He says that even hospitals in Khartoum have been attacked and turned into military bases.
The situation there in Sudan is very much deteriorating. The violence is making the delivery of healthcare services there increasingly very difficult. For example, in Khartoum, around 16% of the healthcare facilities are functioning fully. 23% of them are functioning partially, and 61% of them are not functioning at all.
Our correspondent in Nairobi, Paul Adams, has more on the estimates given by the UN Refugee Agency.
They reckon that a further escalation of the violence will trigger further flows in all of the directions that we've seen so far. In other words, north to Egypt, west to Chad, and south to South Sudan primarily. Those three countries taken together, I think, have now seen the arrival of around 70,000 people or so. It's also worth remembering that a similar, possibly larger number of people have been displaced within Sudan, and they have fled the areas where there is fighting and found shelter in other more peaceful communities. So there are those twin phenomena, but clearly the view from the UN is that unless the situation can be brought under control, unless the two sides can be convinced to stop the fighting, we could see much, much larger numbers of people on the move. And obviously that would make the humanitarian implications of this much, much more serious. But at the moment, all you see on the ground is what looks like a concerted effort by the Sudanese military to try and flush the Rapid Support Forces out of Khartoum, because the RSF is well embedded in certain densely populated areas of the capital, and to try and get them out by force can only have disastrous consequences.
Paul Adams. Our colleagues at BBC Arabic are behind the new World Service programme's emergency radio service for Sudan, which will be available from 3 p.m. GMT. It will include eyewitness accounts and news on diplomatic efforts, as well as providing information on where to find emergency supplies. The radio service is also called Lifeline, as Adel Solomon, who's leading the project, explained.
As the name of the program will do, all the content focused on helping the people in Sudan to manage their life in a war zone, basically. So there will be advice, there will be update, there will be information, there will be even reports about misinformation. And more importantly, the program will be a platform for Sudanese people to talk, express their views and concerns, and communicate.
Of course, the internet is patchy in Sudan due to events. So how can people tune in?
That's why we launched these two programs on short waves, so people can listen to us on short waves rather than, as you know, your communication is not good, internet is not quite available widely, TV is not that available as well. So shortwave hopefully will do that. And Sudan has been historically one of the biggest market for Arabic service as listeners of radio. And the Sudanese community also is a very close community. So the word of mouth also is a way of communicating the news and information about what is available.
And of course, BBC Arabic is in touch with people in Sudan. What are they telling you?
It's a horrible situation, very dire situation. People are, you know, restricted in the way they move, restricted in the way they get the food, the water. It's a dire situation. Everyone almost, you know, wants a way out or at least finding a way to sustain themselves while they think how to continue or how to get out. It's basically, we hear hundreds of stories every day from everyone in Khartoum, which was so remotely perceived away from war. Now the war is in the middle of Khartoum.
This is described as a pop-up radio station. How do you do something like this so quickly? Because the need is immediate.
Because the team is still there, in the radio team and other members of the Arabic service, and the studio is still there. So we just made our best to launch a program. And today we will have a program, a new program.
Adel Solomon from BBC Arabic. And the service will be broadcast twice a day for the next 3 months at 0900 Sudan local time on 21510 kilohertz and at 1700 also local time on 15310 kilohertz. The programs are also available online. Well, let's hear from one region from which people are fleeing, and that's Darfur, a large region in the west of Sudan, which has been ravaged by conflict for the last 20 years. The fighting centred on the Janjaweed, or ethnic Arab militias, supported by the Sudanese government, attacking local populations. 20,000 people from Darfur have crossed into Chad in the last couple of weeks. Many of them are now living without shelter and little food or water. The BBC's Chris Iwoka went to Chad to speak to some of them.
This is the eastern boundary of Chad with Sudan. And behind me is a part of West Darfur. People fleeing the conflict in Sudan cross over from here easily into Chad territory. And hundreds of them have been received and been supported by aid agencies.
On the faces of the new arrivals and those already in the refugee camp, I saw devastation, frustrations, and suffering. Some have managed to bring a few belongings. A few came with their animals and anything to ease the hardship. Once again, families from Darfur have disintegrated, lost in another spike of violence. It's now double tragedy for 83-year-old Ibrahim Bashir Ebra and his wife, Makanesim, who lost their livelihoods nearly 20 years ago. They have never recovered from that conflict, and now they have also been sick.
I still have three teenage daughters who are students, but they've been kidnapped by the Janjaweed militia. I don't know their whereabouts. I'm now left with my wife, who's an old woman, and my youngest child. I was attacked by the Janjaweed. They confiscated all my livestock, and I was left with nothing to live on. I became destitute, without a home, and totally dependent on others.
Before they fled, Ibrahim's wife was robbed of all her money while trying to get to a hospital in West Darfur for treatment.
2 months ago, I was sick. While I was going to the doctors, the Janjaweed attacked us and looted my money. I was left with nothing, and I got back home without seeing the doctors.
For many like Ibrahim and his wife, all they needed is food, shelter and safety after making the dangerous journey across the border. Others have spent years on the move. Mahmoud Adam Hamad and his family say it's the only way to survive.
We kept running, dodging the attacks from place to place until we eventually decided to leave. This year, things got worse. No place is safe anymore. We've had to leave the country.
The United Nations says At least 20,000 Sudanese refugees have crossed into Chad. The country is already the largest host of refugees from Sudan. At a temporary camp in Kufrun alone, there are 8,000 refugees. Humanitarian agencies fear the situation could explode.
BBC World Service's Chris Iwaka reporting. It was a series of gruesome discoveries. More than 100 followers of a doomsday cult were found in mass graves in Kenya last month. Now the leader of the group has appeared in court. Paul Mackenzie Ntenge is accused of exhorting his followers to starve themselves to death to enter heaven before the world ended. In court, the prosecutor, Vivian Kambaga, outlined the case.
The investigations do not just centre on the murder charges and on the mass manslaughter charges that we pointed out to this court earlier on. My lady, we are looking at charges under FOTA, we are looking at charges under the Proceeds of Crime and Money Laundering Act. We are looking at very complex investigations, my lady.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, told me more.
Pastor Mackenzie set up the Good News International Church in 2003, and he prophesied that the world would end in June this year. So he's been accused of inciting his followers to starve to death in order, as he said, to meet Jesus. So far, 109 bodies have been found. Pastor Mackenzie is a former taxi driver who turned himself in on the 14th of April after the police had received a tip-off and entered the Shakahola Forest near Malindi. That means place of treating people's problems in Swahili. The pastor was reported to have owned 800 acres of this forest near Malindi, and it had biblical names like Judea, Nazareth, Bethlehem, etc. And the Red Cross said they're still searching for more than 300 people who've been reported missing. And those who tried to leave the cult were branded traitors and would often face violent attacks. The church leaders were supposed to be the last to die, so that the people that starved themselves to death were firstly children, then the unmarried, then mothers, then the elderly. And Pastor Mackenzie, he said he'd closed down this church, but there were sermons still on YouTube up till quite recently when he preached against vaccines, modern medicine, homosexuality and formal education.
Yeah, I mean, more than 100 people dead. What could he face if he's found guilty?
So he could face the death penalty, although Kenya has not actually executed anyone since the early 1980s. When people were hanged for treason after they led a coup attempt against President Moi. And in 2016, President Kenyatta commuted thousands of people on death row to life imprisonment.
And another man, a televangelist, is due to appear in court too.
That's right. So Ezekiel Odero is due in court in Mombasa on separate charges, but they're still connected with this cult and the deaths. He's facing various charges such as murder, aiding suicide, abduction, radicalisation, fraud, money laundering and child cruelty. And both these men are believed to have shared business interests in including a TV station. And as a result of this scandal, President William Ruto has intervened and promised to set up a commission of inquiry and to clamp down on unauthorised religious sects.
Richard Hamilton. Now, it's going to be a great night here in the UK in the town of Wrexham in the north of Wales with an open-top bus parade to celebrate the men's football team's promotion to the Football League after 15 years. Among the crowds will be Wrexham's Hollywood owners Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. Our reporter Peter Gillibrand has been following the football fairy tale.
Final whistle goes! Wrexham are back!
The celebrations began after the final whistle 2 weekends ago. Wrexham's men were back in the English Football Leagues after 15 years. There were tears, cheers, flares and elated fans at the racecourse ground. And tonight that party's going to start again with an open-top bus tour in honour of the women's record-breaking season two. Thousands of people are expected to line the city streets. The club's Hollywood co-owners, Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney, told S4C they're so proud of the club.
I live in a sort of constant, slightly perpetual state of elation.
Diolchenfawr am bopeth.
Cymru am byth.
The owners will be in Wrexham today celebrating and preparing for League Two.
Peter Gillibrand. Still to come, we hear what it was like working as a World War II codebreaker.
A colonel who was interviewing me said, "Here's a railway warrant, get yourself to Bletchley." Well, I'd never heard of it. I hadn't the slightest idea what went on there.
We'll be back right after this.
15 years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Before being questioned, the only suspect in the case had fled the UK to Yemen. I made a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair, part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Anger has erupted in the Palestinian territories after the death in Israeli custody of Khadar Adnan, a prominent member of the militant group Islamic Jihad. He died after several weeks on hunger strike. The Israeli authorities, who charged him with terrorism offences, say he'd refused medical treatment and was found unconscious in his cell. Following news of his death, people have taken to the streets across Gaza and in the occupied West Bank. At a protest near Jenin, Khadar Adnan's 9-year-old son, Ali, joined in chants calling his father a hero. Rockets were fired from Gaza into Israel, and the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority accused Israel of killing Khadar Adnan on purpose. Doud Shahab, a spokesman for Islamic Jihad, vowed revenge.
The occupation forces bear full responsibility for the death, and we will fulfill our role in confronting those crimes and those assaults, in particular this crime, which led to the martyrdom of Sheikh Khadar Adnan.
But the widow of Khadar Adnan has said that she wants no bloodshed. I asked our correspondent Yoland Nell in Jerusalem to tell us more about Khadar Adnan.
Well, Khadar Adnan was a senior figure in Islamic Jihad. Of course, that's a group that's seen by Israel and many other countries as a terrorist organisation. He was only 45. He was from Jenin in the north of the occupied West Bank and a father of nine. And over the past two decades, he'd really been in and out of detention by Israel, mainly in this controversial state of administrative detention, so kept without charge. And he had gone on hunger strike at least five times and become a household name for Palestinians as a result. He was last arrested in February and began this hunger strike very soon afterwards. And on this occasion, he was charged with supporting terrorism, affiliation with the terrorist group, with incitement, and he was due in an Israeli court this month.
Why was he on hunger strike this time?
I mean, he'd repeatedly gone on hunger strike to protest against the state of administrative detention, also against conditions and the accusations that were against him. Now, as you were saying, the Israeli prison service has said that he was refusing medical treatment. His family and his lawyer, an Israeli NGO which sent a doctor to visit him, said they had been calling for him to be transferred to hospital. So that is likely to continue to be a point of contention. We know that he had been refusing even basic medical tests to monitor his state, and he had set conditions for undergoing medical exams, such as visits by his family, a doctor from this NGO, Physicians for Human Rights, accompanying him for the tests, and the information not being shared with the Israeli prison service. But his situation had become extremely bleak, and just the latest visit from a doctor from Physicians for Human Rights said that he was struggling to move, hold basic conversation. He was pale, weak, exhausted, and had become dangerously emaciated.
We heard the spokesman for Islamic Jihad calling him a martyr there. How influential is this group among ordinary Palestinians?
I mean, certainly Islamic Jihad does have a strong following still, particularly in the Gaza Strip, where we had three rockets fired soon after news broke of Khadar Adnan's death. Those landed in open areas with no one being hurt. And really, at the moment, the concern is that there could, of course, be further action. The Palestinian factions, different Palestinian factions, have called for rallies to take place in the occupied West Bank. We could see further action by Islamic Jihad in Gaza, where it has got its biggest presence, where it has this large arsenal of rockets, or in Jenin, which is a stronghold for militant activity in the West Bank, where Khadar Adnan came from. So at the moment, Israeli security and military forces remain on a heightened state of alert.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. As you may have heard in our earlier podcast, Hollywood film and TV writers were in discussions to get better pay and working conditions. Despite last-minute talks, they were unable to reach an agreement with studios including Disney and Netflix. So now, thousands of screenwriters are officially on strike for the first time in 15 years. The BBC's Sophie Long has been speaking to some of the screenwriters.
We are not neurosurgeons. We are not curing cancer. We are all very well aware of that. But as a person who has turned to the comfort of my television in times of horror and sorrow and tragedy, I think what we do is special and I think it deserves to be valued. And I wish we didn't have to fight so hard.
At 53, Nicole Levy is an established screenwriter. And whilst there will be a cost to her professionally, she's confident she can get through the strike. For her, this is about the writers of the future, including the young women of colour following in her footsteps that she mentors.
For me, as a historically underrepresented writer, crucially important, right? Someone fought so that I got an opportunity to be in this business and to grow my skills and become a showrunner. So I have to fight so that the person coming behind me will still have that opportunity.
It's been 15 years since writers last closed their laptops, left writers' rooms and studios, and took to the streets. Since then, just as streaming services have fundamentally changed the way we watch television, they've also changed the way people get paid to make it. Writers say they're getting less to do more, and some can no longer support themselves with writing alone.
We respect the writers, and we respect the WGA, and we couldn't be here without them. We don't want to strike.
But the studios that produce their shows, once driven by ratings, are now more concerned about profitability. And amidst a dip in their stock prices, all the major players have been cutting costs and laying off staff. Here's Ted Sarandos, co-CEO of Netflix.
We really don't want this to happen, but we have to make plans for the worst. And so we do have a pretty robust slate of releases to take us into a long time. But just be clear, we're at the table and we're going to try to get to an equitable solution.
Well, the two sides failed to reach an agreement before the deadline. The extent of the impact of the strike will, of course, depend on how long it lasts. But scripted talk shows will likely drop off air pretty much immediately, as Seth Meyers warned viewers of his late-night show at the weekend.
What the writers are asking for is not unreasonable. And as a proud member of the Guild, I'm very grateful that there's an organization that looks out for the best interests of writers. So if you don't see me here next week, know that it is something that is not done lightly and that I will be heartbroken to miss you as well.
The writers have the support of stars like actress and director Olivia Wilde.
I support the writers, and I think it'll affect all of us. It'll affect every part of the industry and people beyond the industry. But, you know, we have to stand up for our rights.
Last time writers downed tools, they didn't pick them up again for 100 days. Everyone here in Hollywood is hoping that a compromise will be reached more quickly this time.
Sophie Long in Hollywood. Tensions are increasing on the border between Chile and Peru, where hundreds of migrants are stranded. Many are Venezuelans hoping to cross into Peru as they try to make the long journey home. However, they're often denied entry because they lack documents. Clashes have erupted and one Peruvian police officer was injured after being attacked by migrants with sticks and stones. Venezuelan Yasmari Soto has been stuck on the border with her whole family for almost a week.
I worked in a school in Venezuela. As everyone knows, the economy forced us to leave our country and we chose Chile. In 2021, I asked for a permanent visa, but it still hasn't arrived. One of my daughters wants to study, so we managed to pay for her university for a year. But my husband lost his job, the rents went up, the services became more expensive, the food as well. Then I lost my job and we couldn't pay for my daughter's university anymore. We couldn't apply for a grant because we still didn't have a permanent pass. I got in legally, so I decided to go back to Venezuela by the land border. We've been here in the border for 5 days, sleeping rough, with no answers about what will happen to us. And we have to stay here all day under the sun with no answers. We're human beings. We don't deserve to be here.
Ismari Soto speaking to the BBC's Guillermo Olmo, who has recently returned from the border. He told us more about what was going on there.
The influx of migrants arriving from the Chilean side of the border is increasing. Every day you have a number of people arriving, and the way through that border is getting more and more restricted. The Peruvian government a few days ago imposed a state of emergency, and the military has been deployed in the area, and they are checking everyone trying to cross. As you mentioned, most of them, I would say, don't have proper documents, so they are not allowed in by the Peruvian authorities. So for them, they have to stop there. And they are trying to make their way, if they can legally, or if they not, they may try to cross the desert illegally. But that is becoming more difficult because the military is now there and the security presence has been increased. What I saw there is that those of them traveling with children, the largest families, were being allowed in, but very little by little. Yusmari eventually made it. She should be now in Tacna on the other side of the border. But they are all facing a long way ahead. I mean, we are talking about people who are meaning to travel on foot or by bus or by road or whatever means they can get to Venezuela. So that means crossing almost all South America.
Our correspondent, Guillermo Olmo. One of the last surviving women to have worked for the British Army on cracking both the German and Japanese codes at Bletchley Park in England during World War II has written a memoir of her extraordinary life. Betty Webb's book, No More Secrets, tells the story of her childhood, recruitment to Bletchley, and then the Pentagon in Washington and her vital wartime role deciphering enemy communications. My colleague Martha Carney asked her how she came to work at Bletchley.
I joined the ATS, the Auxiliary Territorial Service, did my basic training, and was then sent to London to be interviewed. They'd picked up that I was German-speaking, and I had an interview in German in London. At the end of it, a colonel who was interviewing me said, "Here's a railway warrant, get yourself to Bletchley." Well, I'd never heard of it. I hadn't the slightest idea what went on there, any more than anybody else did, because it was so secret that nobody was allowed to talk about it.
And you were just 18. What are your first memories of arriving?
Having to read and sign the Official Secrets Act, which is a formidable document, and you realise as soon as you've signed it that you're very much cut off, because I wasn't allowed to tell anybody where I was and what I was doing. My parents didn't know where I was, and I was never able to tell them because they died before the veil of secrecy was lifted. You just say to yourself, well, that's it. And there's no way that you can talk about anything that you saw, read or heard outside your own office. I just said, I'm doing a boring secretarial job, and left it at that. And that I had to maintain until 1975.
And now you are able to talk about it and write about it. And what was your role?
That's right. Oh, I was just one of many, I suppose you could describe us as clerks in a way. I mean, there were different duties, but the very clever people did the translating. But bear in mind, there were well over 5,000 people there in the end. The numbers grew day by day because of the volume of work which had to be got through.
And you say just a clerk, but the work that you were doing collectively was very important, wasn't it, for the war effort?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, what we were reading, the enemy messages, the Italian, German and Japanese, gave us an insight into where the next offensives would be. We reckon it shortened the war by 2 to 3 years.
Did you hear about those machines now that are very famous, the Enigma machines?
I didn't have anything to do with them myself. I was more on the clerical side of things. But obviously, we all know much more about them now.
Betty Webb, veteran World War II codebreaker. Finally, the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has led tributes to Gordon Lightfoot, who has died in Toronto, aged 84. Mr. Trudeau said that Canada had lost one of its greatest singer-songwriters, whose music captured the country's spirit. Bob Dylan once described Gordon Lightfoot as a mentor and said that he wished his songs would last forever. Wendy Urquhart looks back at his career.
In the early morning rain, with a dollar in my head.
Gordon Lightfoot was one of the founding fathers of folk rock and highly respected in the music industry. In the 1960s and 70s, a plethora of stars, including Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Bob Dylan and Barbara Streisand, were lining up to record his songs. His first album, Lightfoot, featured the hit songs Early Morning Rain and For Lovin' Me. But his song Black Day about the Detroit race riots in 1967 struck the wrong chord with radio stations and was banned in several American states. At the time, he said that radio station managers cared more about playing songs that made people happy instead of songs that made people think.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell.
His 1970 hit, If You Could Read My Mind, went gold, and his career took off like never before. Suddenly, he was an international star. But heavy drinking and smoking destroyed his health. He became teetotal in 1982, but only after he was told cirrhosis was round the corner if he didn't stop immediately. His hometown was hugely proud of him, and in 2015, a 4-metre-tall bronze sculpture of a cross-legged Lightfoot playing guitar was erected in Orillia. His last album, Gordon Lightfoot Solo, was released in 2020.
Wendy Urquhart looking back on the life of Gordon Lightfoot, who has died at the age of 84. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Annie Smith, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martina Vik Magnussen went missing after a night out with friends in London.
I wonder what on earth could have happened.
We were so obsessed with just finding her.
Then
Magnussen ble drepen etter å ha blitt påført.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
I'm Noelle McHaffey, and I've been following this story since Martina was killed, making a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened and find the only suspect in the case. Farouk Abdelhak.
Leave me a message and I'll get back to you.
He's never been questioned by the police. Nobody's been able to speak to him. Until now. Murder in Mayfair. You can listen to the whole story now. Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.